This is the state of things from the Upstage Cabaret in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio, and you know, if you watch any TV at all, it is not hard to spot ads aimed directly at children. Whether it's a commercial for the latest online gaming fad or for a new kind of breakfast cereal, the message is clear. Kids, you can be consumers too. Social scientists have long been outspoken about the effect of TV advertisements on children's psyche and development, but historian Paul Ringel argues that this practice has been going on for a very long time, long before the invention of television. His new book, Commercializing Childhood, Children's Magazines, Urban Gentility, and the Ideal of the American Child, looks at how children's magazines in the 1800s established relationships with American families that introduced children to the consumer's market. Paul Ringel is a professor of history at High Point University and joins me now here at the Upstage Cabaret. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Frank.
So how did you get interested in this question of when we began advertising to kids, or at least in magazines?
Well, it actually was an accident. I was up at Brown University at the library, and I was looking for something completely different. And I was working with a librarian who pulled down a book that was called Under Dewey at Manila, which was a children's book about the Spanish-American War and about how a boy had stowed away on Dewey with Dewey's flotilla to end up in the Philippines. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting, and sort of stowed it away. But when I got home, I started sort of digging into it a little bit and found out that it was one of a series of books that had been written, about 8 or 10 books that were written between 1898 and about 1908, about all these different adventures that young American boys had overseas with the Boxer Rebellion and the Russo-Japanese War and all these, you know, fairly obscure foreign conflicts. I got really interested in how publishers were trying to convey this really kind of complicated experience of imperialism to children. And so I wrote a graduate school paper on that. And when it came time to write a book, I decided instead of looking at books, I wanted to look at children's magazines, because I thought the magazines, because they were coming back weekly or monthly, they had to have an ongoing relationship with the children and with their families. And so I thought that would have more insight, give us more insights into how this culture of treating children as consumers developed.
And it turned out that it went back farther. That is, the children's magazines in the United States went back farther than you thought.
Yes. I actually thought when I started, I thought I was going to start with two magazines called St. Nicholas and The Youth's Companion. Those are still two of the major magazines that I focus on in my book. But St. Nicholas started at 1873, and that's where I thought I was starting. But The Youth's Companion actually went all the way back to 1827. And then I found a magazine, another magazine in Boston, which is also where The Youth's Companion came from, that started in 1826. So I was amazed that it went back that far. And so that's where I began.
So tell us a little bit about, let's start with The Youth's Companion and a little bit about the sort of the philosophy of that magazine and who was really targeted, because at that point you're actually targeting the parents, right?
Yeah, really up until about the Civil War, the children's magazines mostly focus on targeting the parents, and the idea is that the children will be so thrilled to get anything sent to them in the mail with their name on it that they'll read almost anything you send them. So it's actually The Youth's Companion and another magazine called The Juvenile Miscellany, both of them in Boston, that I think were part of this larger kind of cultural conflict between Orthodox and liberal Protestants in Boston that were kind of competing for cultural dominance. The historians have called that the Unitarian controversy. It goes back to a struggle for control over Harvard early in the 1800s, but it continued through this sort of wave of evangelical revivals and resistance to those revivals, and I think these magazines came out of that conflict.
You use a term, you've coined a term called genteel sensationalism that was a form that you saw in The Youth's Companion. Tell us about that and sort of how it played into this controversy.
Well, that actually comes from the kind of the second generation of The Youth's Companion, but it does sort of play in. The first editor retired after 30 years in 1856, and he handed the paper, they called it a paper, over to a new editor named Daniel Sharp Ford, who started his first issue on January 1st, 1857, with an image of human sacrifice in the Fiji Islands. He had this picture, and there had never been a picture this big on the front cover of the magazine before, but it was a picture of a 50-foot wicker man with Fiji Islands calendars pushing other members of their community, or maybe, you know, opposing members of their community, I wasn't really sure, into this wicker man and getting the combustible materials to light it on fire while other people are kind of writhing on the ground in distress that their relatives and friends are about to be burned to death. And I was just shocked by this. And so I looked onward, and for the first 3 months that Ford was editor, he had a series of these kinds of sensationalized pieces, and one was about pearl divers in Japan who were being attacked by sharks, and one was about the Crimean War, and they were showing a soldier with a cannonball coming at his head. So there were all these really sort of violent and shocking pictures, and they were all on the cover, and they were all accompanied by these tiny little stories. So clearly the picture was the purpose. It wasn't the story. And they were all pictures that were from outside America, and other than the Crimean one, they were mostly non-Christians. And so what I think he was doing, and the evidence sort of builds that I'm quite confident about this, is he was using these sort of sensational stories to make his evangelical message that here are the things that will happen if we don't pursue Christianity and if we don't convert the non-Christians in the world to Christianity.
But Ford is a kind of a genius in that he also understands how to sell magazines. So yes, he realizes that the violence is really what's going to attract people. But if we frame it in a right way and we make sure that it's all of these others, these Fijians who eat their own young and others, then we can have any kind of mayhem occur and then teach the lesson, so you better be a good Christian.
Right. As long as we have the moral at the end, he can get away with almost anything. And this is particularly for older boys, because by 1857, when he takes over the magazine, the idea that kids will read anything that you give them is becoming less likely, because there's more options, especially for boys living in cities. They can read all sorts of exciting things like crime newspapers and go to see all sorts of sensational shows and things. And so he's got to try to attract those people so that he can keep the audience going week after week.
Now, I mean, we're talking here about moral formation, so we haven't really gotten into, strictly speaking, consumerism, buy stuff, right? But before I do that, I want to say that there seems to be a limit to the, or at least the topics that you can talk about and write about when it comes to moral formation, because one successful magazine took a foray into abolitionism and failed pretty quickly.
Yeah, that was the Juvenile Miscellany, which was actually the first magazine that came out in 1826. And for the first several years, for about the first 6 or 7 years, it was much more popular than the Youth's Companion was, and it had all sorts of cachet with the elites in New England and the literary community. But around 1831 or 1832, its young editor, Lydia Maria Child, met a man named William Lloyd Garrison, who was one of the leading abolitionists in the country, really the leading white abolitionist, and he converted her to abolitionism. And she very slowly, you can see this happening over the course of about 18 months, she very slowly starts to insert abolitionism into the magazine. So she starts in Africa, and she says, you know, look at the horrible things, these children are being kidnapped in Africa. And I think the first story is actually about an African prince. So it's royalty, and it's and so she slowly starts with that, and then it seeps down into the Caribbean and Brazil, and as it's still not in the United States. But finally, in 1833, she just breaks down, and I think, honestly, I don't have the smoking gun that tells me this for sure, but I'm quite certain that she knew she was done, that she'd already pushed it too far. And so she kind of thought if she was going to go out, she was going to go out with a bang. And so she puts out this story about two young girls who get kidnapped by a slave trader in, I think it's in Missouri. I'm not sure, but I think off the top of my head, it's in Missouri. And one of them gets released because she's white, but the other one gets sold into slavery, and they're best friends, and they've grown up next to each other, and you know, so the story ends with this girl sort of being distraught that she's never going to get to see her best friend again.
So and that ends the magazine then.
Well, that it doesn't it end with her. That issue, but
pretty
quickly after that, the magazine collapses. She gets fired, and within about 6 months, they actually bring in somebody else, Sarah Josepha Hale, who wrote the Mary Had a Little Lamb poem, to try to take over. But it doesn't work, and after about 6 months, it's out of business.
So a little more about how morality plays, and again about Ford, the editor of the Youth's Companion. There's a great letter that you have in your book that he writes to Louisa May Alcott, who contributed to his magazine.
Correct.
And he tried, well, tell us about that letter and what it was that he wanted her to massage a little bit.
Yeah, so it's the closest thing, I talked about a smoking gun a minute ago, and it's the closest thing that I have to an explicit explanation by Ford of what he's doing. So Alcott has been writing stories for The Use Companion for several years by the time this comes out, and she submits one to him about a ball. It contains a ball. It's a serial story that's going on for weeks and months, but it contains a ball. And he sends her this great letter that says, I love the story. I love what you're doing. But the ball is going to be problematic for some of our readers. You know, it's not so much it's problematic for me, even though I am an Orthodox Christian, but some of our readers aren't going to like it. So can you make the ball, can you make it so that there's no dancing? Or can you make it a social instead of a ball?
He's worried about the Puritans,
yes.
Right? And the dancing was the problem, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing because he's got this dance that he does. We'd read it, but it goes on for like 9 pages of this foreign language that's sort of trying to get Louisa May Alcott, of all people, to change this. So that's the dance that's going on in terms of moral formation. We can do it as long as the bad guys and the lesson here is some other, particularly, and it's helpful if it's a racial other, Fiji, for goodness sake.
Yes.
How could that be any more exotic? But when it comes to headline news, better be careful. Watch out for stuff that's in the news. Abolitionism.
Although that starts to change after the Civil War a little bit. He starts to be able, he does this for about 3 months in 1857 and it abruptly disappears. And I don't have any clear answer as to why, but he does sort of slowly, the Civil War, he gets even more conservative to sort of protect children from the violence that's going on around them. But he slowly sort of starts to filter in these stories again, almost as soon as the war ends. In fact, the day after the war ends, the cover of the magazine is a little boy sneaking out of the house to go do something nefarious. So he does, by the 1870s, start to tell stories about children who are doing bad things in the United States, especially in cities.
Well, that gets to something that one critic referred to as the romance of rascality.
Yes.
This is an objection to what was working class literature that, you know, had these kind of ambiguous characters.
Yeah, and Ford takes the ideas. He doesn't come up with these ideas for The Companion out of nowhere. They come out of this kind of working class literary culture of story papers and sensational magazines. And he sort of, I think he makes it more genteel and sort of sanitizes it for a middle class audience. But there is a kind of an ongoing concern about this. In the 1870s, you get Anthony Comstock, the famous vice reformer, who takes on dime novels and who says that they're doing really awful things. And if you read these dime novels now, they don't really seem like much. But he sees them as, you know, the moral crisis of our time that's just corrupting our children. None of this ever gets directed specifically at The Companion, but it does sort of, he takes language from Comstock, sometimes verbatim, in his stories, saying, you know, you can read us, but don't read this other stuff, because it's going to be exactly what Mr. Comstock is saying.
They romanticize rascality.
Yes, exactly.
Which is comical in a way, because then we think about the comic books, the same critique leveled against comic books in the 40s and 50s, and then television, and now hip-hop.
And movies in the teens
movies,
and 20s. It's
hip-hop,
just a cyclical. It happens thing. About every 20 years or so.
So what about consumerism? Where does that fit into all of this?
Well, the reason I think that this is about consumerism is that it's the way that the editors were able to make a kind of a market product for children that would meet the rules of genteel society. And so there's a really interesting conflict that runs through 19th century treatment of children. If you read a lot of popular literature, things like Uncle Tom's Cabin, there's always, you know, children who are exposed to commercial culture are corrupted. Sometimes they're morally corrupted, sometimes they're literally physically corrupted. And so it's seen as this terrible thing, and yet at the same time, and this isn't my insight, this came from someone else, but he says that at the same time that they're talking about how commercial culture corrupts them, Americans are building a commercial culture for children, and they're trying to figure out a way to do it, because as they move into cities in the urbanization process of the 1800s, they feel like children have to know how to navigate market cultures in order to prosper when they're young adults. And so you've got this sort of balance that you gotta find between, we don't want to corrupt them, but we don't want them to be unprepared to be successful adults. And so I think these magazines were really a way to toe that balance, right? To give us a way to be consumers in a way that's still respectable and genteel.
Yeah, you've got Daniel Sharp Ford at one point warning girls not to get too consumed with fashion because
right.
it will turn them into I forget what it was going to turn them, something bad.
Yeah, well, the danger with boys is they go into the city and get corrupted by their employers or by other young boys, and they become embezzlers or criminals and end up on the gallows. The danger with girls is they become too obsessed with fashion and finding the sort of the fashionable husband, and they end up either married to a horrible man who abuses them or has to go to jail himself, and therefore they end up alone with children, and they don't go to the gallows, but their life is ruined.
Hmm.
So that's the divide he makes.
What about gender, and how were these pitched? Were they pitched mostly to boys, to girls? Was there a balance in whose these stories were about?
It changes over time. In the 1820s, really up until about the Civil War again, at least until Ford takes over in 1857, it's pretty gender neutral. And most of the early magazines use the word youth, which is not only gender neutral, but fairly sort of age. It's a vague age range that starts when children are old enough to leave their parents' side and go play without their parents' immediate supervision and goes until they're economically independent, either by being married off or leaving the house to take their own jobs. But as you head towards the Civil War and certainly afterwards, you start to see this process that keeps going now, that they start to divide stories and features along gender lines and along age lines, and the magazines become increasingly departmentalized. So there's not only the stories for the older boys, there's stories for the older girls, and there's stories for the younger children. And they become, by the time you hit the turn of the 20th century, there's all these different departments that are trying to specifically target all different ranges and genders of kids.
What about now? What are the biggest differences you see, or are there, in the tactics that we use now to market to kids?
Well, I think one of the big differences is that sort of divide. It's not a difference, but it's certainly accelerated. We've talked about, you know, now we have tweens and teens, and none of that stuff existed in the late 1800s, early 1900s. The other thing is, I think it's really a sort of a product of the success of these magazines, which is that we talk about how we're going to market to kids and what's appropriate to do and what's not appropriate to do, but we no longer talk about whether we're going to market to kids. That's gone. That's done. And I really think a lot of that is because of the successful work that the magazines did.
Paul Ringel, thank you so much. A professor of history at High Point University. His book is called Commercializing Childhood, Children's Magazines, Urban Gentility, and the Ideal of the American Child. And you can find out more about Paul Ringel and his book, as well as links to other articles at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to talk with three sisters, a very young group of girls called the Dan River Girls, and you will get a little sample now. And when we come back, much, much more. Please stay with us on The State of Things first, the Dan River Girls.